You're listening to the ILLA podcast, the online home of lectures and conversations hosted by the Institute for International Law and the Humanities at the Melbourne Law School.
Well, good afternoon, everyone. Welcome to the Melbourne Law School. Let me begin by acknowledging that we meet on the lands of the Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nations, who are the traditional owners on the lands on which the Melbourne Law School stands. We recognise elders past, present, emerging, those knowledge holders who cared for country and had very little impact on atmosphere, biosphere, hydrosphere, other components of the climate system. So we have much to learn. My name is Margaret Young. I'm a professor here at the Melbourne Law School and director of our Institute for International Law and the Humanities, which is delighted to host this very important seminar. We are hosting this in collaboration with the Melbourne Centre for Law and the Environment, and we're facilitated in this by a very special research partnership between the Melbourne Law School and Cambridge Law Faculty, which has helped support a research visit from Cambridge academics, including Professor Caro van Asselt. So we really mark our thanks to that particular research fund to enable collaboration between so many academics in those two institutions, lawyers and non-lawyers, who are working on so many really important areas of climate law and policy. And perhaps premier amongst them is Professor Caro van Asselt, who is the Hatton Professor of Climate Law at the University of Cambridge. This is a new position. Caro is his inaugural holder, and I think it's a real recognition of the importance now that climate change law has in the legal discipline, domestically and internationally. So many of you would have been following the Conference of the Parties meeting in Baku a couple of weeks ago. You may be still following the International Court of Justice advisory opinion oral proceedings, which have been streamed for us on UN Web TV. And you might also be following the domestic cases that are occurring here in Australia and also abroad and regionally, which are considering issues of law. Caro recognised very early on, decades ago in his career, that international law, domestic law were connected, international law was fragmented, a lot of attention was being put in biodiversity, in forests, in climate. Caro brought that together in his very first book and has been continuing to work in this field, most recently recognising the blind spots on the supply side of fossil fuels, recognising that the climate treaties haven't yet really found a way to harness ambitions to reduce reliance on fossil fuel, to reduce it at the supply side rather than at the demand side. So we've benefited a lot from Harrow's scholarship in this area, and he's going to take us to his particular area of interest at the moment, looking at international law processes, phasing out fossil fuels, why and how. He's going to speak for around 30 to 40 minutes, and we then have an opportunity for questions. This seminar is being recorded, but we won't be reproducing the question and answer part of the recording. So please feel free to not have to go on the record with your question, but ask very hard questions to get him out of his jet lag, to keep him awake for today. Okay, so please join me in welcoming Caro. Thank you.
Right. Thank you, Margaret, for that wonderful introduction. And indeed, thanks to the Melbourne Law School and Cambridge Law Faculty Partnership for allowing not just me, but also, I see all of them here, six of my Cambridge colleagues also coming to Melbourne for this series of events. So my talk today will be about one of the key questions in international climate change law and basically what to do with fossil fuels. And it shows that it's one of the key questions in international law and international climate change law if you just turn your eyes to what's happening in The Hague at the moment. And maybe just as a brief aside, at 2 a.m. Tonight, there will be the submission from the International Union for the Conservation of Nature, to which Margaret and myself have contributed. So if you're feeling like staying up late tonight, you have something to watch. But what I looked at particularly with a lot of interest were some of the submissions and some of the oral interventions that were made on the 2nd of December starting with my Cambridge colleague, Jorge Vinuales, who was one of the few people who was there arguing on behalf of Vanuatu, and making a very clear statement about fossil fuels and international law in the context of climate change. Right, like you can see the arguments that Vanuatu put out there is that basically the conduct, the required conduct of states is very clear. States that have contributed to climate change and are required to not only have deep cuts in their emissions, but also in their production of fossil fuels. And from an international law perspective, this is a very novel and important argument. He then also goes on to basically say that they haven't, and indeed, as I'll also talk about later today, is that indeed states are continuing to extract fossil fuels. But then if you continue to watch on the 2nd of December and all of this, you can look back on the UN, the webcast channel, you'll also see that Saudi Arabia, a few hours later, was making a rather different argument, saying here that the specialized regime on climate change, so the Framework Convention on Climate Change, and the Paris Agreement provides no basis whatsoever for the court to recommend any limits on fossil fuel production. So this is basically the context of my talk today. So trying to see, well, not necessarily who is right, but what does international law say about this very facts question? So before I go to talk about international law, let me just say a few things about the science of phasing out fossil fuels, or what scientific studies say about phasing out fossil fuels. Now, the first thing to note here, see if it's working. Yes, the first thing to note here is, of course, that fossil fuels, including the oil, coal, and gas, the burning of fossil fuels is very clearly the single largest contributor to climate change. So it's contributing to 90% of global CO2, carbon dioxide emissions, as well as 75% of global greenhouse gas emissions. So in short, if we are to do something about climate change, we have to address fossil fuels. However, if you then go back to, in this case, COP28, so the COP in Dubai at the end of 2023, there were some people, including in this case the COP president, so this is Sultan Al Jaber from the United Arab Emirates, who also happens to be the head of their oil and gas company, saying that actually there is no science, no scenario that suggests that the phase out of fossil fuels is going to help us keep below 1.5 degrees of global warming. And he did this in a conversation with former Irish President Mary Robinson. He then later on backtracked a little bit, but this is one view on the science of climate change and the science of phasing out fossil fuels. Now, let's look into some of these studies and to what extent can we actually see any indication that maybe we do need to phase out fossil fuels. Now, I want to be clear, though, there's no one single study that authoritatively says we have to phase out fossil fuels to stay below 1.5 degrees warming. However, there are a number of very important studies that give us a very clear indication of what needs to happen. So starting with the IPCC's synthesis report of the sixth assessment report, clearly indicating that existing fossil fuel infrastructure, without any additional abatement, and we'll talk about that in a second, would already exceed the remaining carbon budget for 1.5 degrees with 50% probability. So that's quite a significant message. Another significant message, and it's very interesting to see this being very heavily cited throughout submissions to the ICJ, is from the so-called production gap report from the UN Environment Programme, which suggests in its latest iteration that in aggregate, governments are still planning to produce more than twice the amount of fossil fuels in 2030 than would be consistent with limiting warming to 1.5 degrees. So it's basically the projections of governments in terms of fossil fuel production are already indicative that they will go past 1.5 degrees. And then last but not least, we also have the International Energy Agency's Net Zero by 2050 scenario, the report thereof, which indicates that in their 1.5 degree scenarios, there is no space for new oil and gas fields or new coal mines. Now, all of these studies do not necessarily suggest a phase out of fossil fuels. They do give an indication that new fossil fuel production would not be in line with 1.5 degrees. It also gives a clear indication that what governments are planning is not in line with 1.5 degrees, but it doesn't necessarily give us very clear guidance in terms of what needs to happen with phase out. And part of the reason, if we go to the next slide, is that a lot of these assumptions or a lot of these studies depend on assumptions about negative emissions technologies, about carbon capture and storage, about carbon dioxide removal. And if you have a very optimistic view, then maybe a fast phase out will not necessarily be necessary. However, if you're more pessimistic about the potential of carbon capture and storage and about carbon dioxide removal, then you actually may need to have a bigger emphasis on phasing out fossil fuels. And there is good reason to be conservative. And I don't know if you can see the figure. It's probably a little bit too small. But there's good reason to be conservative about carbon dioxide removal. First of all, because of the scalability. Right? There are ultimately land use constraints and other constraints, which means that we cannot just scale up. We cannot just plant a whole world full with trees and then hope that they will suck up all the carbon out of the atmosphere. There will be physical constraints to that. But on top of that, there are also cost-related constraints, and this is what this figure is indicating. It's from a study from Oxford University, indicating that basically addressing climate change with carbon capture and storage would be $30 trillion more expensive than without. So again, there are good reasons to be conservative, but even if you're more optimistic, even if you're more positive about carbon dioxide removal, then even then you'll see, and this is what the figures, the numbers show here as well, is that a quite drastic reduction in fossil fuel production will be necessary under whichever scenario. So with an optimistic assumption about carbon dioxide removal, we're still talking about a 95% phase out of coal and 62% for oil and 42% for gas. And then if we are more conservative, we see that for coal, we almost go down to 100%. For oil, we go down to 70% and for gas to 84%. Now, it's also maybe just important as a caveat to say that a full phase out, right, like completely getting rid of fossil fuels might be difficult to think of in for other reasons as well. And this is because there are so-called hard to abate sectors like aviation, some in the industries and agriculture, where it might be difficult or very, very, very expensive to get rid of fossil fuels altogether. But under all of these scenarios, under all of these assumptions, we are still talking about a very drastic reduction of production of fossil fuels. So this is just to provide you with the scientific context. So let's move on to the role of international law. And what does international law say about fossil fuels, if anything? So in doing so, I first want to talk a little bit about general international law and what that what general international law and international environmental principles say about fossil fuel production. And then I'll discuss, in turn, international climate change law, international human rights law, and international investment law as three more specialized bodies of international law that say something about the phase out of fossil fuels in one way or the other. Now, in general international law, a very clear starting point is the prevention principle in international environmental law. The principle is a corollary to the also very well-known principle of permanent sovereignty over natural resources, but it limits this principle of permanent sovereignty by indicating that states have the responsibility to ensure that activities within their jurisdiction or control do not cause damage to the environment of other states or areas beyond national jurisdiction. Now, the principle only applies to significant harm, but if you're interested, and again, it will be online later today in the IUCN submission, we argue, and I would also argue here, that any warming above 1.5 degrees would indeed automatically qualify as being significant. Now, in the context of fossil fuel production, the principle prevention can be translated into a customary duty for each state to exercise due diligence, to assess and address environmental harm from greenhouse gas emissions linked to upstream fossil fuel production. And again, if you look at the Vanuatu submission, you'll see a lot of this type of argument also being highlighted there. Now, this doesn't necessarily immediately say that every state has a requirement to phase out fossil fuels, but there are a number of procedural obligations that can be linked to this due diligence obligation, this duty of due diligence. Importantly, there would be an obligation to carry out a transboundary environmental impact assessment that would take into account the so-called Scope 3 emissions of fossil fuel projects. So in other words, it including the emissions from the burning of fossil fuels by the end user. And there are also other procedural duties, which, again, if you look into the case law of the International Court of Justice, you'll see is highlighted in a number of cases, including pulp mills and the Costa Rica-Nicaragua case. They include consultation, notification, and cooperation with affected countries. And also, I think, importantly, states would need to monitor the effects of their actions and, if necessary, take mitigation measures. And these mitigation measures in the context of fossil fuel production could then mean, for example, restricting unabated fossil fuel production, limiting financial support for fossil fuels, as well as potentially banning exports. Now, moving on to the specialized areas, and I'll start with international climate change law. And I think important first remark is that if you are looking for concrete guidance in any of the climate change treaties about fossil fuel production, you won't find it. There are some references to fossil fuels in the Framework Convention on Climate Change in the Kyoto Protocol, but this is more about the situation of fossil fuel producing states such as the Middle Eastern countries and the impacts of mitigation measures on these states' economies. If you look at the Paris Agreement, there's not even any mention of fossil fuels whatsoever. That doesn't mean, of course, that what the Paris Agreement states is not relevant in the context of fossil fuel production. And we can start by looking at its overall goals. And here one could argue that based on the goals of keeping warming certainly well below 2 degrees and ideally below 1.5 degrees, this would then require a winding down of fossil fuel production and use to meet those goals. And this is also what some of the studies that I've just shown very clearly indicate. Beyond the temperature goal objective, we also have a separate objective related to financial flows in Article 2.1c. So there's the goal of shifting financial flows away from carbon-intensive activities. So that would also mean away from fossil fuels. But beyond the objectives, there are also specific provisions and specific obligations that we can find in the Paris Agreement for states. And of course, one of the most concrete obligations is for states to adopt 5 yearly nationally determined contributions. But then importantly, in Article 4, those nationally determined contributions also need to reflect the state's highest possible ambition. And here one can make the argument that if states, even though they're adopting their nationally determined contributions, but if they're at the same time also providing licenses to oil and gas, or if they're opening up new coal mines, one could argue that they're not necessarily reflecting the highest possible ambition in their NDCs, in their nationally determined contributions. And lastly, one could also argue that the Framework Convention on Climate Change, as well as the Paris Agreement, give clear guidance on what needs to happen with fossil fuels through its principle of common but differentiated responsibilities and respective capabilities, where one could argue, based on that principle, is that developed countries ought to take the lead based on their capacity, based on their also greater responsibility historically seen to the problem of climate change, so that they would have they would be guided to make sure that they would take the lead in phasing out fossil fuel production. Now, this is broad guidance at the treaty level. If we go beyond the treaties, we actually see a little bit more specificity in COP decisions. And of course, I think all of you will probably be aware that COP decisions as such are not legally binding. But they do exert some normative influence. And here it's interesting to see that that at least some of the COP decisions in recent years have actually started to mention individual fossil fuels and most recently also all fossil fuels. And this all started in a few years ago in Glasgow at COP26 in the UK, where states agreed in a COP decision that they would accelerate efforts to phasing down unabated coal-fired power. So this is not about coal production, this is not about coal mining, but really about the use of coal in electricity production. But even then, this was the very first time that a particular fossil fuel was singled out as a mitigation option, as something that needed to be addressed to address climate change, which one would argue is maybe 30 years overdue, given that the convention was already in place in 1992. But it still was an initial start. A year later, there were some efforts to in Egypt, in Sharm el-Sheikh, there were some efforts to extend this call to all fossil fuels, but that didn't succeed. But and then in COP28 in the United Arab Emirates, it was finally a decision that did include a call for parties to take on a range of mitigation efforts, including transitioning away from fossil fuels in energy systems. Now, there's quite a few caveats if you look at this decision in details, right? Like, so it can do so in a nationally determined manner. They need to take into account different national circumstances. But even so, the fact that this was very hard fought, like this was very contested at the time. So the fact that it was included in there in the first place is already quite telling. I also think it's important to note that this decision was also an outcome of the first global stocktake, right? Like, so every 5 years, countries need to come together to basically see and assess where they are. But then the stocktake outcome then needs to be taken up in the next round of nationally determined contributions. So the idea is that countries would need to indicate how they've included these calls also in their next round of NDCs. Whether they will do so, we will see in the next few months, but at least there is this basic obligation. The COP28 decision also included a number of other calls. So there also was a call to phase out inefficient fossil fuel subsidies as soon as possible. There also was a repetition of the call to phase down unabated coal power. But also, at the same time, there was a recognition of the role of transitional fuels, which one could argue is code for fossil gas, in the energy transition. So this was one of the things that was necessary as a trade-off to keep some countries, including in the Middle East, on board. Now, so this is the guidance, roughly speaking, that we're seeing from the climate regime. Again, not a very clear call for phasing out fossil fuels, but at least fossil fuels are mentioned, and there's at least an indication that this transition needs to happen to achieve climate goals. Moving on to the next area, which is increasingly relevant also in the context of fossil fuel production, but more generally in the area of climate change, because we see a number of court-related cases, both at the domestic level as well as at the international level, all drawing on human rights law in the context of climate change. So basically, under various human rights treaties, states have an obligation, a negative obligation, to refrain from human rights violations through contributing to climate change impacts. But they also have a positive obligation to prevent non-state actors from interfering with human rights and taking action to allow everyone to enjoy their human rights. Increasingly, these obligations have been interpreted with a view also to apply to fossil fuel phase-out. And I think one of the best ways of in which this was expressed was in a joint statement by several human rights bodies, including the Committee on the Rights of the Child and the Committee on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, providing a clear statement that states parties, based on the different human rights treaties, should effectively contribute to phasing out fossil fuels. In addition, if you're interested in this, I think there's a wealth of suggestions. Also, if we look at different reports from special rapporteurs and independent experts on human rights, including David Boyd, who's shown on this picture, which provides specific suggestions of what exactly states ought to be doing to comply with their human rights obligations. And maybe as a basic suggestion, it would be the suggestion that all states have a positive human rights obligation to ensure a just transition away from fossil fuels. But then there's other specific suggestions as well. So all states would have an obligation to assess the impacts of fossil fuel projects on global warming. One report suggests that states have an obligation to limit fossil fuel lobbying, which in a number of countries is very relevant. All countries would have an obligation to end fossil fuel subsidies. And another suggestion is to prohibit certain forms of fossil fuel extraction, such as ultra deep water drilling. Now, the point with all of these suggestions is not necessarily that they are reflective of what human rights law actually says, but they do provide an indication how it can be interpreted. Right, like, so what the independent, what all of these special procedures, so the independent experts and the special rapporteurs say is not necessarily what states accept to be the human rights law in this particular area, but it does provide a clear indication of how it could be interpreted. Now, moving on to the final body of international law that I want to highlight here, which is international investment law. And it's increasingly becoming relevant. And one may wonder, well, what kind of obligations might one find with regard to fossil fuel phase-out from investment law? Well, here I would say that the types of obligation that one find may find is actually limiting states in what they can do about a phase-out for fossil fuels. And that is because investment treaties offer protection for fossil fuel investment. So this ultimately may lead to a range of investment arbitrations, and if they are successful in these arbitrations, that may also lead to specific compensation, which can really amount to quite a lot of money for states if they want to pursue fossil fuel phase-out measures. And just to show that this is not a hypothetical scenario, we already see a number of these disputes happening. Right, like, and a number of these disputes are happening based on countries adopting phase-out measures to achieve certain climate policy goals, and these are increasingly being challenged, including in this very country, right, which you see in the bottom right. So, importantly, we need to think also about what investment law says and what incentives it gives in states actually adopting these measures. It's also important to note that even if there are no disputes, investment law may still provide significant influence on what states are actually doing simply by the deterrent effect that they might exert. So a state might simply not want to adopt a phase-out measure because it's worried that an investment arbitration might start if it actually adopts that type of measure. So this is the phenomenon of regulatory chill, which has been documented at least in a number of countries. Right, so having provided this overview of what international law states about fossil fuel phase-out, and again, not coming necessarily with the conclusive suggestion that yes, international law provides very clear guidance that states should phase out fossil fuels, but I want to look maybe also a little bit forward and see what international law could say and how it could be shaped to actually ensure that fossil fuels are phased out in such a way that we actually achieve our climate goals. And I think it's important to follow three pathways at the same time. The first pathway is really based on a range of soft law initiatives, some of which are already in place. A second pathway would be to align existing institutions, so existing international regimes, and try and see how they can be aligned with the scientific imperative of keeping warming below 1.5 degrees. And the last potential pathway would be to develop a new treaty in this area. And I will discuss each of these pathways in a bit more detail. So starting with soft law, as I said, we already see a range of initiatives and a range of pledges that are relevant to phasing out fossil fuels. To just give you a few examples, we have since a few years, since I think COP27, we have the so-called Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance led by Denmark and Costa Rica, where we have a number of countries as well as subnational authorities pledging to phase out oil and gas production with a view to achieving climate goals. We have focusing on coal-fired power. We have the UK and Canada leading the Powering Past Coal Alliance already for quite a few years. Again, pledging to phase out coal and increasingly getting other countries and subnational authorities to join them. We have since the Glasgow COP, so since COP26, we also have a specific initiative focusing on phasing out international public finance for fossil fuels through the Clean Energy Transition Partnership. And since last year, we also have a new coalition focusing on ending fossil fuel subsidies led by the Netherlands. Now, all of these pledges and all of these initiatives have been launched outside of the formal intergovernmental process under the UNFCCC and the Paris Agreement. I think they're important because they include commitments. Yes, these are not necessarily legally binding commitments. Yes, they're also not necessarily accompanied with accountability and enforcement processes. But they do usually provide for some follow-up in the sense of reporting by states. They also usually go along with the sharing of best practices and dialogue with relevant stakeholders, including civil society and business. And in some cases, they even go hand in hand with specific funding to help some of these initiatives achieve their goals. Now, in terms of the participation, most of them will have some minimum entry requirements in the sense of signing a particular pledge, so a pledge to phase out oil and gas, for example, for the Beyond Oil and Gas Alliance, which means that not every country, of course, is immediately joining. So what we see a lot is they have a number of so-called first mover countries, so countries who have already made some of these pledges domestically and then want to kind of internationalize their domestic pledge. But we also see a lot of participation by climate vulnerable nations, including small island states. Also importantly and interestingly, I think, is that a lot of these initiatives have participation by both non-state as well as subnational actors, showing that not all of the decision-making importance lies at the national federal level. Now, moving on to the next pathway or the next parallel step, I also think it will be important to realign existing regimes. So what do I mean with that? So I'll just give you three examples. So here, if we look at, for example, the international climate change regime established by the Framework Convention on Climate Change and the Paris Agreement, we could see a number of ways in which that regime could be realigned to also achieve to also phase out fossil fuels. That could start at the very beginning by including information about fossil fuel production in the nationally determined contribution, as well as in the long-term strategies that states have to submit, as well as in the transparency reports that states now need to submit every 2 years. One can also imagine that over time there might be some basic guidance about what this transitioning away from fossil fuels actually means in the context of the Paris Agreement. So basically following up on the pledge made in COP28 and trying to flesh out what that might actually mean, even if that guidance is not necessarily legally binding. And lastly, we can also see that through the UNFCCC and the Paris Agreement, we can imagine that in the coming years, there might be financial support dedicated specifically to ensuring a just energy transition away from fossil fuels. If we look beyond the climate regime, we can also think about other international regimes and aligning them with the imperative of a fossil fuel phase out. We can look at, for example, multilateral development banks and other international financial institutions, which to some extent have already put some restrictions in place for fossil fuels. But as you can see from the Guardian headline, that is not necessarily enough at the time. So we can see that, we can argue that these institutions over time could also put further restrictions in place, plus, of course, also helping to support clean energy alternatives. And lastly, when we look at international investment agreements, also here we can think of new ways of aligning these agreements, and there actually are already quite a few discussions about this in place, including at the OECD, which has a specific initiative about this. And we can think about a number of ways. We can think about investment agreements in the future, making a clear distinction between high emissions investments and low emissions investments, so basically giving different treatment to fossil fuel investment and clean energy investments. We can think about carving out fossil fuels from investor-state dispute settlement, which some academics have been suggesting. And we can think about specific suggestions to terminate investment treaties or withdraw from investment treaties to the extent that these treaties are indeed protecting fossil fuel interests. Now, lastly, and as I said, the last parallel step would be to look at the options and possibilities for a new fossil fuel treaty. And I would say this has been, in the last few years, a very successful campaign, and actually one of the campaigners is based right in Melbourne, to really promote this idea and to really give an indication we need to do something about fossil fuel production, and one way in which we can do that is to develop a treaty. And the idea of this campaign is to develop a treaty that would be modeled on the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty, where first the first step would be to basically ensure no new fossil fuel production. Then as a second step, it would be about phasing out in a differentiated way existing fossil fuel production. And lastly, it would be about providing financial support for a just transition away from fossil fuels. Now, importantly, this is an NGO campaign. But at the same time, what is interesting now is to see that this NGO campaign is increasingly being endorsed by states. So we already have a number of Pacific Island nations which have endorsed the idea. And now we also have, since last year, a fossil fuel producer in the form of Colombia actually suggesting, well, this is actually something we can get behind. However, I would also be a little bit more cautious here. I do not think that major fossil fuel producers will sign up to this anytime soon, for reasons that I think most of you can probably well imagine. That doesn't mean, however, that the initiative as such is not valuable. I think it carries quite important symbolic value, quite important normative value, which can then also influence some of the other pathways, including the realignment of existing institutions, including also some of the soft law initiatives that I mentioned earlier. So I think the three pathways that I see will ultimately interact and with each other in trying to hopefully in due course ensure the phase out of fossil fuels. So let me now conclude and wrap up the main points that I try to make clear to you. So first, from a scientific perspective, I would say there is a very clear case for a drastic reduction of fossil fuel production and consumption to meet the temperature goal of the Paris Agreement. That is not necessarily to say that there's very clear scientific insight that we need a full phase out, but still, I think all of the science points to a very drastic reduction of fossil fuel production. Second, from an international law perspective, I think the prevention principle and it's the duty of due diligence, as well as the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, as well as human rights law, all point to this general obligation to adopt measures curtailing fossil fuel production in an equitable fashion. But at the same time, I also acknowledge that the precise contents of states' obligations have not yet crystallized. Of course, I would be very happy if the ICJ would actually try and crystallize that, but I'm not necessarily holding my breath there. And lastly, while I do think that negotiating an actual fossil fuel treaty will be hugely challenging, I also do think that the development of soft law, the realignment of existing international institutions, can act as stepping stones to a possible treaty, and even the very act of pursuing such a treaty can be valuable in its own right. And I'll leave it at that.
You've been listening to the ILLA podcast. To find out more, go to soundcloud.com/ILLA podcast. That's IILLAH podcast.